Okay, we need to get started. So those of you who are here for this session, if you please find us, take a seat. And I want to welcome everybody to session 271, which is entitled, Does God Really Hate Amputees? Or What Does Science and Religion Tell Us About the Existence of God? And my name is Devery Anderson. I'm the moderator for this session. And just want to start off with the usual reminders here for everybody that we want to make sure that your cell phones and pagers and any other noisemakers are off or on vibrate. And if in doubt at all, even the slightest, please check and make sure that it's off or on vibrate. And of course, we will have this session is being taped, of course, so you'll be able to purchase this. And also, with this panel, with a discussion topic, the books relevant to this, the Christopher Hitchens, The God Delusion, Sam Harris, The End of Faith, Letter to Christian Nation, and also the newest one by Christopher Hitchens, God Is Not Great. Those are all on sale in the bookstore at the Benchmark Books table, as well as several other titles related to that. And as the abstract in the program says, this session, the title of the session is taken after a website that Sam Harris refers to in his book, Letter to a Christian Nation, talking about prayer. Is there evidence for prayer? Because people pray for people to be healed all the time. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. Probably the same death healing ratio as people who aren't prayed for at all. And I'm taking the devil's advocate out right here, taking that position. And but in cases of amputees, no matter how many people are praying, fasting for somebody, they never get healed. And so the question was, you know, raised in that, you know, so is there evidence for God really, or is this just coincidence? There aren't any prayers that are answered really that can't be at least written off to coincidence. And that's the position that Sam Harris took based on this site, and his book is all about that. Are there intelligent arguments for God? There are intelligent arguments against God. We see that. Are there intelligent arguments for God that should compel us to believe? And so these books that have come out this last year have all been on the bestseller list, very popular. They all take, you know, kind of the same theme, of course, is there's no evidence for God. It's silly to believe. Should we waste our time doing that? But the issues that they touch on are so many that the panelists here today are really just responding in their own way to these general ideas. We have four panelists on in the session today. We'll be hearing first from Dwayne Jeffrey, who teaches at BYU, has taught there for several years, he's been in the biology department continuously, from what I believe. Current teaching assignments are in evolutionary biology. He's the author of the groundbreaking dialogue article that came out in the early 70s, Seers, Savants, and Evolution, The Uncomfortable Interface, which has since been reprinted. Classic article in dialogue. Also, he's co-editor with Bill Evenson, Mormonism and Evolution, The Authoritative LDS Statements, and also more recently in Sunstone, Noah's Flood, Modern Scholarship and Mormon Tradition. He served in the church, he's a returned missionary, also served in bishoprics, high councils, and has served as a teacher. Is married to Kay, and they have three daughters and six grandchildren. After that, we'll be hearing from Jana Reese, who holds a PhD in American Religious History, Columbia University, and has degrees in religion from Wesley College and Princeton Theological Seminary. She's also the book review editor for Publishers Weekly, or a book review editor for Publishers Weekly. She's also, that's the position she's held since 1999. And she's also author of six books, including The Spiritual Traveler, Boston and New England, which came out in 2002, What Would Buffy Do?, The Vampire Slayer as a Spiritual Guide, Mormonism for Dummies, and Selections from the Book of Mormon, Annotated and Explained. She's also married to Phil Smith. They live in Cincinnati, and they have a daughter, Jerusha. Following Jana, we'll be hearing from R. Dean Watts, and he spent 30 years at the University of Utah as a professor of music. He's also the pianist and associate conductor of the Utah Symphony for 22 years and founded what became the Utah Opera Company. He's also an activist for the arts, peace, and the environment, former general board member of the Young Men's Mutual Improvement Association in the church. He's also been a, of course, familiar face at Sunstone, wonderful friend for several years, leading our music. And he's also married to Elna and been married for over 50 years. And they also have 8 children. And then our final speaker today is going to be Dennis Potter, who received his bachelor's degree from BYU, also went to Florida State University, where he received his master's degree, and Notre Dame, where he received his two master's degrees, it looks like, from what I'm seeing on here, one from Notre Dame, one from Florida State University. And right now he's associate professor at Utah Valley State College, which, is it now Utah Valley State University, or is that?
It will be Utah Valley University in 2008.
Okay. All right. And he's been here at Sunstone for some time, published as well. Some of his Mormon-themed publications include Partakers of the Heavenly Gift, a political reading of Mormonism, which is forthcoming from Greg Coford Books, also The Sacramental Worldview, a philosophical comparison of Joseph Smith's magical view of ordinances with a liberation view of sacraments, which was also in Sunstone, as well as Did Christ Pay for Our Sins, in Dialogue. And he's also a founding member of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology and currently serving on its board of directors. So we'll go in that order. Each panelist will have about 12 minutes, and that should leave us time for some Q&A. Thanks.
I felt that my stance on today's program was probably to try to set the stage for why there seems to be an unusual upsurge in conflict between science and religion. Science and religion, of course, has been an old, old, old topic. It just about forms the basis of Western civilization, I think, going back to Copernicus and Galileo and anybody else that dared to look up in the heavens and think a little bit. But among religious scientists, it seems that science has always been on the defensive. Being identified with a religious institution, I've certainly found that among my colleagues across the country. Not only to defend my religion, but quite what we do with our religion and our science. But what has surprised me sometimes has been that my religion, co-religionists, I guess we could say, like to constantly keep science on the offensive as well. We'll try to maybe get to that a little bit later on. But for most scientists, we're used to seeing attacks on science from organized religious groups. The Institute for Creation Research, Creation Research Society, Center for Creation Research, and so on, and all these sort of things. I forget all the ones of them at the moment, but this goes on and on and on. We'll leave that. They're just there, and I'm sure you've run into them too. But I have never known science to go on a formal or rather organized offensive against religion. There have certainly been individuals that do that. Carl Sagan, of course, became famous for that sort of thing and produced some rather interesting things. But it should be said that cost him credibility among scientists. He got blackballed a number of times for professional organizations because they felt he spent too darn much time trying to attack religion rather than do other things, and he was a very productive astronomer all the same. But I've never seen an organized response, really, from science back to religion, per se, until maybe last year. There was a conference held in Southern California that came very, very close to ending with a formal declaration of war against religion. There were a number of people that were there who are big names, and I won't bother to run through them. It doesn't matter too much. But they really got worked up, and if you want to talk about mob psychology, it really kind of got to that. And there really was a rather call for, listen, we've got to get out and destroy religion, now let's get after it. Fortunately, there were some cooler heads that prevailed and said, let's not be throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. We could be doing more harm than good, and, just cool it. But all the same, there has been a real outpouring of increased vitriol from some of these scientists, and certainly a number of books. Debbie has mentioned a couple of those, but I thought for a moment it might be useful to say why, in the view of these scientists, is such a reaction justified? What's their beef? What's their concern? And as religionists, I think we need to know that. There is concern, for instance, over the health of the planet and of its ecosystems, the constant deterioration of everything going on due to human activity, a recognition that humans have the power to do something about it, but there are some problems in getting there. There is concern over the fragmentation of education and society, of our increasing inability to meaningfully dialogue about these critical problems. We can't even talk to each other in many cases. A number of years ago, I remember when Ronald Reagan was putting James Watt in as the Department of Interior, and he let it be known he intended to develop the mineral rights all around the national parks and in the national parks and drilling and everything else. And why? Because we don't need to worry about conserving anything. Christ is coming within just a couple of years. And the Senate still admitted the guy, validated him, and he became Secretary of the Interior. You may know some of his history since, which hasn't been exactly laudatory. But however that may be, the point is that we are so fragmented, and the fragmentation is increasing. We see this with you know, the responses against the public school systems, which have been our common denominator for making it so Americans can talk to each other. But we are becoming a not only a linguistic, but indeed a philosophical and cultural Tower of Babel. And that is very concerning. These scientists have seen the problems with the growth of anti-science internationally. They see concern over, they have concern over seeing religion thwart the progress of medicine. Who was it that stopped vaccination? You know, we have succeeded in killing one disease, and that was smallpox. Finally, even here in Utah, we had to go through our own stress with that, and it took a first presidency statement in 1900 to try to cool the anti-vaccination feeling here in our own state. We had polio on the ropes. We had it cornered in northern Africa 2 years ago. And it was Muslim imams who let it break free, and now it's international once again, and could have been gone. The resistance currently to stem cell research, the resistance to blood transfusions, refusal for organ donations, for research against HIV, because that's God's, you know, God's judgment on people. The problem that people do not understand scientific research, the problems with statistical sampling and placebos, using anecdotal data to foist off all sorts of frauds upon the country. These people have concern over wars, draining the resources that should be used to try to manage our planet. And so many of those wars are religious-based. I'll let you think through some of the current ones and decide how much you think they are fueled by religious differences. But certainly one can look recently at Northern Ireland and Islamic squabbles, at to some extent the Hutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda, for instance. And we'll see whether this current one is indeed a war between religions or just between cultures, or how much those are the same. These scientists are rather fond of the quote that never can humans be so vile as when they act in the name of God. And I think we have seen incredible validation of that particular thing. So their answer to all this is destroy religion. And the symposium to which I referred came very close to adopting that as a formal operating policy. Certainly individuals have. And so we've had books such as The God Delusion from Richard Dawkins, who's a well-recognized scientist, but recognized mostly for his incredible ability to explain science in simple terms, particularly evolutionary biology. I wish I had the guy's gift of writing. He is gifted in writing, but he is also an evangelistic atheist. And his recent book, God Delusion, falls into the same category as another one I'll mention. That was Sam Harris's End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation. there's really not much wrong with the science in any of those books, either of those books. The problem is the way that science gets used to serve other ends. Both these individuals have bought into a philosophical concept called scientism. And let me try to go for that for just a moment. Rudyard Kipling, you remember, 100 years ago, became famous for books called the Just So Stories. You know, how the leopard got its spots, how the elephant got its trunk, and all this sort of thing. They were ways that you could give children reasons for how things came to be as they are. And they were incredibly popular back in those years. In evolutionary biology, we have talked also about people who invoke science for just so stories. You know, here's a reality, this must be the explanation. And we say, no, you don't put that explanation on the air until you have really validated that that is the explanation. Don't tell us just so stories. But both Harris and Dawkins, I think, get carried away in carrying and telling some just-so stories to try to make science serve some of their anti-religious bias. Scientism, as I have used the term, is the belief, it's a philosophical belief, that science can address any question that is relevant to humans. And any question that is not susceptible to science is irrelevant. Therefore, God is irrelevant, etc., etc. Well, this goes on. And I'm sure Jana and Dennis will probably want to bring me up a little short for those oversimplifications. But for most scientists, Dawkins and Harris have just gone too far. The subsequent then that Devery mentioned was Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, which is really a pathologist's report about religion. If you've ever read the report of a pathologist, you wonder how anybody ever could have lived. But he spends all his time just dictating his, just revealing his very carefully garnished data on how religion has been bad for humanity. And one of his reviewers says, I've never seen anybody write a book about a subject he seems to have understood least as to write a book about religion. However that may be, then we have such things as Andrew Newberg's book, who's a neurobiologist, that Why God Won't Go Away. And we need to recognize that religion is not going to go away. It's too powerful, too meaningful. It's going to be around. And you gave me one more minute than I thought I had, Debbie. So let's look at some quick responses from highly respected religious scientists. First of all, I'd like to mention a book by Joan Roughgarden, who is a highly respected evolutionary biologist at Stanford University, and whose recent book, Evolution and Christian Faith, tries to indicate how she finds a rapport between evolution and her Christian religion. Owen Gingerich, from Amish and Mennonite background, is a astronomer emeritus at Harvard University, highly recognized and so on, and his book on, God in the Universe, what is it? I think something like that. He's impressed with the magnificence of the universe, but he does not get tied up in anthropic principles or intelligent design or that sort of thing. He's quite aware of the limitations of some of those. Francis Collins, molecular geneticist, evolutionary geneticist, who was the federal government's main man on doing the Human Genome Project. Incredibly well-respected. Atheist turned evangelical Christian. And his book, The Language of God, tries to spell out his reasons for his religious faith. Well, what would be an appropriate response then for an LDS audience? I would like to suggest a role model, maybe of some sorts at least, with E.O. Wilson, probably one of the world's greatest respected evolutionary biologists, emeritus professor at Harvard, raised Southern Baptist, became atheist, but has recognized now that there is a very real problem, that science is not going to alone be the answer to all these problems that I indicated. And so his recent book, The Creation, is a book to an imaginary Southern Baptist pastor. He says, I've been there, I've been under the water, I've been to the altar, I kind of know what this is all about. But he said, we've got to combine forces between science and religion and work together on these. I would like to tie together some LDS history and scriptural stuff, I think, that adds that a powerful message for Mormons, and get back to the old Mormon idea, now almost forgotten, that God works through natural laws. And to suggest that we should not be looking for any synthesis of science and religion, because both science and religion change. Even for LDS who think LDS and religion doesn't change, it does. And so a synthesis between the two, where the energy that can be brought to bear by religious commitment can be teamed together with the know-how from science to maybe solve some of the problems that our planet faces. Thank you.
Well, I'm not planning to call you to task for anything, and if I'm allowed to say this in an atheism panel, amen, brother. I'm Jana. I think that I was asked to be on this panel for two reasons. The first is because in my day job, I see the whole proliferation of atheism books and also the response books, which I'll talk about. And secondly, I think on a personal level, even though I'm a Latter-day Saint now, I grew up in a family of atheists, agnostics, anti-theists, and I don't know, we had everyone. In the whole spectrum of if agnostics are the most tolerant and open-minded, atheists are in the middle, and anti-theists are at the other extreme, we kind of covered all those bases. So this is a topic that I'm personally interested in as well. What's interesting to me from a professional standpoint about this new wave that we've seen of atheism books is that most of the people who are reading them would not consider themselves to be atheists or agnostic. Christopher Hitchens does not hit the number one spot on the New York Times list by only speaking to his niche audience, because a generous amount would be 4% of America would call themselves non-believers. Probably it's more like 1% to 2%. And so obviously there's a whole contingent of people out there who don't necessarily agree with Hitchens, but who are buying his book. Why? I think that it's backlash. I think that the religious right totally deserves this. When people have been asked, I mean, granted, what I'm about to tell you is fairly anecdotal evidence, but the research that we've done at PW, at Publishers Weekly, shows that religious people are buying these books. Liberal Christians, liberal Jews, are buying atheism books because they are so ticked off at the religious right for becoming the sole representative force of religion in America, that there have to be alternate perspectives and other views. So they buy these books as a sort of act of social protest. I wanted to talk about a couple of atheism books that have flown under the radar, that, you know, they're not the Hitchens and Dawkins and Sam Harris books and are actually considerably better and less extreme. One of them, which has a ghastly cover, terribly, terribly boring. This is called Nothing, subtitled Something to Believe In, and it's a memoir by Nika Lally. She lives in Brooklyn. And one of the reasons that I like this book, in addition to being interesting and well-written, it is her autobiography, is that she's the only woman who's writing an atheist book. If you look on the shelves, there's a terrible gender divide right now in the atheism books and also the response books, mostly by evangelical Christians. All of those books are being written by men. And when a woman finally writes one, it's a memoir, it's an autobiography, basically saying, oh, well, this is my experience. You know, but it is a fascinating book, and I think it offers something a little different to the table. I heard a panel in June, it was a standing room only setting at Book Expo America, where Hitchens, Nika Lally, and a physicist named Victor Stenger were all together speaking about their beliefs and about their most recent books. And Nika Lally said that she wrote the book, quote, to prove that being a non-believer doesn't mean you're an empty person. Because part of the rhetoric of the religious right in America is that anyone who disagrees must have no spiritual bearing and no morality. She says that the extremism of some of these atheism books, Christopher Hitchens in particular, she had an interesting perspective on that. And this is a quote. She said, we've been silent for so long, closeted, maybe afraid to say we don't believe. If you tape somebody's mouth for a long time and then rip the tape off, the first thing they're going to do is just scream. That pent-up rage has to come out. You don't have to be nice, obviously. And when she said that, she pointed to Hitchens. We've all been accused of not being nice, and it's weird. People write you letters that tell you that you're going to burn in hell, and then they tell you that you're not being nice. So I highly recommend Nika Lally's book. She makes some very good points about religion not having a corner on the market of morality. Many of you may be familiar with Christopher Hitchens' book. That's the one that has really jumped to the forefront this spring and summer, following on the heels of Dawkins and Harris last year. And Hitchens, most extreme, I would say, of that trio, he says that the fight between civilization and religion threatens everything that civilized individuals hold dear. He calls religion foolish, puerile, idiotic, and wicked, says that it is child abuse, and that he's glad it isn't true. Hitchens actually has been helpful in clarifying the spectrum I was talking about with agnostics, atheists, and anti-theists. An anti-theist is someone who is glad that it isn't true. An anti-theist would never say, well, I wish that were true, but I don't believe. Hitchens has made a very clear mark in the sand by saying that it would be like living in a permanent North Korea to believe in God. It would be so confining and repressive to him. He had some very interesting things to say about Mormonism as well. Apparently, he believes that America now has a political candidate who is a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and makes the comparison between Mormonism and the Klan because Mormonism has a similar, in his mind, racist history and continuing racist views. So, interesting guy, Christopher Hitchens. Now, you can imagine that religion publishers and religion authors are not taking this sitting down. And so we've seen in the last year particularly, and I see from catalogs forthcoming for the spring of next year, that this is going to continue. This whole cottage industry of atheist response books, primarily written by evangelical Christians. And I would say that there's very little actually that's different from the old style apologetics, except that they're answering some of these issues in a very focused way. But almost every Christian publishing house has at least one of these books this year or next year. And some of them are specifically responding to the books themselves. For example, one called The Dawkins Delusion, an answer to Richard Dawkins's book, The God Delusion. And I would actually point to that as one of the best of these books. It's one of the most gracious. It's written by a fellow who's he's a British theologian and scientist. So he is coming at it from at least a more informed point of view than some of the other schmoes who just sit down and say, that makes me mad! And then they decide that they have to write a book too. So, you know, the book The Dawkins Delusion is definitely worth checking out. I think that we are going to see this settle down. In publishing, there are always spikes and trends, and then after a couple of years, they die down. So after that happens, though, it will be really interesting to see how this has changed the landscape, how this has changed the debate. I don't think that Christians in America, in particular, are going to be able to just assume that they speak for everyone, because apparently they don't even speak for their own readers, let alone the entire nation. And what does that mean for religion discourse in this country? It'll be really interesting to find out. That's pretty much all I have to say, but I'll be happy to answer questions later if you have any about publishing.
I haven't the slightest idea why I'm here. Except that 2 weeks ago there must have been some kind of crisis in putting together this panel. And empty chairs are not indeed tolerable. It's an incredible honor for me to be in the setting with a panel like this. Dwayne and Jenna, professionally have visited areas I've not even thought of existing. But I happen to, quite by accident, I happen to have read all three of those books within the last few weeks before Dan Weatherspoon called me and said, would I serve on the panel? And they were at the same time so disturbing and so exhilarating that I wanted to find out where I really stood. So I revisited all three of them to some extent in the few minutes that I could glean, and my impressions have been virtually the same as those that you've heard from Jana. That is, Mr. Dawkins appears to be extraordinarily well-informed. He certainly touched on a lot of places that were blank spaces in my mind, but it was obvious that he was really angry. And one of the things that I had to give up when my path took me away from the Mormon mainstream was proselyting. And since then, I have avoided being in any kind of position that I thought might be interpreted as trying to get somebody to change from one belief to another. I certainly do not feel that my belief, which really doesn't belong to me, but which is borrowed from many, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of sources, which I can't even name, nevertheless, have deep meaning to me, just as your faith in a deity or deities or no deities has for you. And so I certainly prefer a gentler way of addressing the issues and a respectful way. In addition, I found Sam Harris to be less informative, but just as angry. And I found Hitchens to be still less informative and still more angry. So you can take your pick if you're going to visit one of those. On the other hand, I feel that for content, there are many aspects of their arguments that spoke very tellingly to me. Up to age 46, I was comfortable with Mormon speak in describing any god or describing my god as somebody who was a personal being who answered prayers and is mixed up in human affairs. My testimony, so-called, included somewhat vague but nevertheless powerful interventions, as in answered prayers and miracles, of which I seem to be the beneficiary. When I was given permission to follow my own path in what I consider to be an act of grace that I certainly did not seek nor expect, but which indeed changed me as I saw my Mormon heritage simply melt away one afternoon at 2:00. And I have been rebuilding ever since. Since then, I have resisted any institutional affiliations in favor of free exploration of everything that's out there, resulting in what is probably a religious or non-religious smorgasbord. Now, 33 years later, I find myself increasingly reluctant to articulate feelings or concepts about God. I guess you could call me a quasi-Taoist, Certainly there are aspects of Taoism that are very mystical, very theistic, and spiritualistic, but what appeals to me from Taoism is the first chapter, which says that that which can be described is not the real thing. They call it the way, I call it God. I have not utterly given up prayer, wonder, or gratitude, or an intent to be a good person, but I am absolutely clueless as to the indirect object of whatever of those feelings which resist definition. Complicating this is my growing revulsion for proselyting, which I've already mentioned. I support our grandchildren who go on missions. I have 40 grandchildren, by buying them new clothes when they come home. I could probably be a Unitarian Universalist in the broadest sense, but they're far more missionary-minded here in Utah than I can handle. Besides, I see no advantage in giving up one self-important institution for another with the same institutional disease. I lean more toward pantheism than deism, and willingly confess that when I read everybody from Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, Thomas Huxley, Bertrand Russell, Richard Dawkins, even, I feel that I am more in more reliable company as to cosmic matters than the testimonies of the faithful that I'm exposed to every day, including those of my wife who is here. Among the cultural artifacts of our time that I treasure most are CDs and books, and I used to trust Revelation more, and now I trust my CDs and books. I doubt that anybody will see this as progress, but I do. Through them, I have instant access to much of the wisdom and beauty of the wisest and most accomplished beings who have graced our planet. An advantage to surviving into my 80th year is having the leisure to follow my inclinations. Although I'm both intuitively and mentally incapable of testing every hypothesis that I go through. So I have to rely on my own intuition, which I admit I probably would have called the Holy Ghost at one time, to help me discern those things that I care to incorporate and synthesize into my own life. I resist the categories as means of sorting things out. Fact and fiction has blurred. Sacred and secular, scripture and fantasy are just among the few who have come to overlap so much that they appear to be indistinguishable. For half my life, I attributed those deep promptings to the Holy Ghost. I prefer now merely to cite my own tuition as the prevailing authority. And that is the mindset that I bring to this discussion, and perhaps my only contribution. While the explosion of books debunking religion at this particular time, I think Jana has addressed that beautifully, I don't see it as a purely United States phenomenon. Dawkins and Hitchens are both British. I suspect that the war on terrorism, supported jointly by the U.S. and Britain and others, has weakened support for both democratic government and organized religion, and that that is one of the immediate causes for the spate of books that has come out challenging religion. All three of the religions of the book admit the possibility of a God who is capable of anger, usually considered a vice in humans, and with a history which not only condoned but commanded atrocities which rival many that we are witnessing today. Our citizenry, I think, can be excused for concerns about Mitt Romney, because Mormons share a relatively fundamentalist view of Scripture with evangelicals. At the same time, religions of the book have conspicuous evidence that their God also enjoins their followers to mercy and compassion and forgiveness and mercy and redemption. I guess that one must conclude that there is a failure in the world for those of religious persuasion to modify or influence the work of their governments. I have a very close friend who is Chinese, and I have spent a great deal of time in the last 2 years with things that relate to China one way or another. And when I probed her on a number of occasions as to where her values come from, since she appeared to have pride that she was an atheist, she said, "Well, from my parents, of course." "Well, where do they get it?" "Well, they get it from our cultural tradition." "And what happens," I said, "when you indeed can no longer stand your parents interfering in your lives, and you want to get out, and you think everything that they've taught you is baloney?" And they said, "Well, then our teachers take over when we go to school." "And then what happens when you no longer are willing to listen to the teachers?" She said, "Well, most of us go to boarding school then, and then we learn morality from each other." Maybe it's not too bad. Talking about gods may be dangerous to your health. I'm likely in trouble by agreeing with the first principle of all three of those authors, whom we have referred to, in saying that people create gods. Gods do not create people. The best name I've found for a creator of people is evolution. I do not call evolution my God. I call it a theory, because it satisfies me in ways that no explanation that I have ever heard or read could do. Our gods make up for our ignorance and inadequacies. They're extensions of ourselves. To not have a powerful God is to admit our own inadequacy in understanding and in imagination. Gods don't have to be called gods to be them. God problems begin when we extend the territories of our gods to interfere, to invade the territories of other people and their gods. And then we become godmatic. You can tell I'm in sympathy with the authors above on many points. They have not found existing gods that turned them on. I was blessed with the opportunity to search for one that turned me on. Secondly, they make a big point, and a good one, I think, that our sense of morality is independent of our faith in any deity. And I stand as my own exhibit A. I remember what it was like to be a strong believer And I know what it is like to be a non-believer, and I think I am essentially the same person. I believe that in a positive way, these authors have flung down the gauntlet before all believers to look carefully at all of their convictions and act accordingly. Thank you.
Our dean, I found it ironic that while you were talking, they were singing Amazing Grace over there. And I think that maybe some of that might be imparted unto you and you will find faith again. I don't know. I'm going to start off with a story. Not too long ago, I asked my daughter if she wanted to get baptized. She was 12, and I hadn't been around her for a while. And so I didn't know where she was at exactly. She reads Scientific American and National Geographic. She's 12. And she told me, "No, Daddy, I don't believe in God." I said, "Why not? Why don't you believe in God?" "Because I believe in science." For a 12-year-old, that is a sophisticated position, I think. But Dawkins doesn't go much further. Dawkins only goes further in this way. He understands science. Who published these books? Is this a peer-reviewed press? Hitchens' book? Is Houghton Mifflin, is that a peer-reviewed press? Do they have people who actually know about philosophy of religion and philosophical theology, look at these texts and peer-review them and see if the arguments had any kind of merit whatsoever? No, they didn't. This is trite. I'm serious. I'm an expert in this. I actually am really, when it comes to some of the issues that they're talking about in here, I'm the only expert on the panel in this. I mean, Jana does religious studies, but religious studies very often, unless you decide to include philosophy of religion in that, and a lot of religious studies people don't, religious studies brackets out the question of the truth of religion. And they're saying religion's false. And they're also saying it's really, really harmful. And they're making horrible arguments for it. Arguments that are as bad as Ann Coulter's arguments. And so that's what I want. And remember, Ann Coulter was also on the best-selling list. And there's a connection between them and Ann Coulter. And that connection is that they both have the same view of what Christianity and religion is. And that view is a naive, idiotic view. It's this view of this, you know, God in the sky with the beard, and he's mad at us all the time because we're doing horrible things, and that we should read the Bible literally, and that the world was created in 6 days, and, you know, hardly any Christians believe these things. But this is the portrayal of religion, of Christianity, that Dawkins gives. It's the portrayal that Hitchens gives. It's a straw man argument. If you knock down an idiotic version of a view of the world, you haven't done any real interesting work. And so what all they're doing is helping the fundamentalists, because they're reinforcing that picture of what religious faith is. Have any of these guys read Moltmann, for example, or Rahner, or Leonardo Boff? There are some really sophisticated theologians out there. And the views that they have of God, the views that they have of the relationship between God and humanity, aren't even touched by the arguments here. So let me start giving you some examples. One example is Dawkins seems to think that you don't have to have any kind of, or religion, you have to have faith, and faith is going to be blind. And that, you know, people who have this kind of faith, they just don't think about it, right? And what I've just said shows that that's not the case, right? Because there's theology departments all over Britain, there's theology departments all over the United States. People do think about it, and they think carefully about this stuff. I teach philosophy of religion, I think about it all the time. It's all I think about when I'm not thinking about sex or I don't know, some television show. Or politics. All I think about is philosophy of religion. And when I had faith, and I admit that I'm in a point right now that I don't. But when I had faith, it was faith. But it was faith that was critical. And I think he misses that boat. And here's something that's really interesting, too. David Hume, a couple centuries ago, gave arguments against the basic principles of the scientific method, against the rationality of the basic principles of the scientific method, or at least the ability to show that, prove these with philosophical arguments, that they're rational. And these arguments are so compelling that philosophers of science are still arguing about them. David Hume's arguments are so compelling. It's really difficult to justify the principle of uniformity of nature, which is assumed as part of the scientific method. It's really difficult to give a justification for induction that doesn't itself assume induction, and yet they just assume this framework. That's fine. It's great because it gets us somewhere, right? And I have no problem with it. I have no problem with science. I'm not saying there's something wrong with science because they do that, but there's faith there too. So that's one misunderstanding. I'm not going to talk too much about Dawkins because I don't do science, and I'm not going to do like these guys do and try to talk about something that I'm not an expert in. I'm going to talk about stuff that I am an expert in. Hitchens is the worst, and the reason that he's the worst, and so that's why I want to go after him actually. The reason that he's the worst is because he has this British accent. And he's articulate, and so people think he's smart. But he actually makes horrible arguments most of the time. He does know quite a bit about the history of American imperialism. And when he was in the right fold, namely, left-wing radical politics, when he was writing for The Nation, he actually did some really good work showing, for example, that Henry Kissinger is probably a war criminal, that we supported Pinochet, the coup down there. And I mean, he's done some really interesting things in that regard. I'm going to skip this. I'm going to give it a different example here. This is a claim that he makes. He says, there still remain four irreducible objections to religious faith. That it wholly misrepresents the origins of man and the cosmos, that because of this original error, it manages to combine the maximum of servility with the maximum of solipsism. I don't even know if he knows what solipsism means. That is both the result and cause of dangerous sexual repression, and that it is ultimately grounded on wish thinking. And he says that religious, that there are no responses to this, that as if we all have agreed, yeah, we can't respond to any of those, and that is all we do in philosophy of religion. I go to the Society of Philosophy of Religion, or the Society for Philosophy of Religion, and the Society of Christian Philosophers, and the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, and there's atheists there. That's what they do. They do philosophy of religion. They're atheists. They're arguing against the existence of God. And there's theists there, and they're arguing for the existence of God. And sometimes, in some of the discussions, I agree with whoever argued last. Because the arguments are so damn good. And they don't. It doesn't address them. And let me give another example of a really bad argument. Because he undermines his own case. I'm going to go ahead and read this. In 1996, the Irish Republic... Oh, wait, no, that's the wrong one. Hold on. In Belfast, I have seen whole streets burned out by sectarian warfare between different sects of Christianity, and interviewed people whose relatives and friends have been kidnapped and killed or tortured by rival religious death squads, often for no other reason than membership of another confession. There is an old Belfast joke about the man stopped at the roadblock and asked his religion. When he replies that he's an atheist, he is asked, Protestant atheist or Catholic atheist? Now, I teach a class on religion and violence. This is one of my areas of specialty, and I've done it in Belfast. And I have friends in Sinn Féin. Don't worry, I don't fund the IRA or anything. But, I mean, I know this from the inside. I've been there. I've talked to these people, and that's right. When you're an atheist, you're still Catholic there. But notice something. He's trying to establish that religion causes violence, and he points out that when in Belfast, when you're an atheist, you're still a Catholic. So Catholic is not a religious thing anymore. Catholic is an ethnicity. He's showing that there's something more to that conflict than religion. Religion's not causing that conflict. Go there and look at the socio-political, economic conditions in Belfast, and you'll understand that religion is used as a way of justifying a conflict which is more fundamentally economic, more fundamentally social. Same thing, Gaza Strip. 95% of the Gaza Strip is occupied by Palestinians. 5%, well, this is true a while ago. 5% was occupied by the Jews, and they had something like access to 80% of the water. That doesn't have anything to do with why the Palestinians are mad. It's just Islam. It's just Islam and Judaism. They can't get along. Then what he does, and this is, I want to talk about a technical logical fallacy. He goes through and he just enumerates all these bad things that religions have done. You know, the priests that have, and it's horrible, the priests that have abused children. What else does he enumerate? Mormons not giving blacks the priesthood. I'm sorry? Yeah, genital mutilation. Actually, human sacrifice in the Incan and Mayan traditions, which are, of course, not around. Sexual repression. He hates Mother Teresa. And actually, to tell you the truth, I'm kind of with him on that. I think charity is a problem. I think that we have to change the systemic situation. But nevertheless, he enumerates all of these cases. Mother Teresa flies into Ireland to try to stop them from legalizing abortion there, and he enumerates that as another case of religion doing all these bad things, and he takes them from all these different religions. He takes these cases. And then he concludes this. Religion leads to all of these things, this list of bad things. And he's taken individual cases from different religions, and he says religion in general leads to all of these things. This is both, it's two logical fallacies at the exact same time. It's a fallacy from anecdotal evidence, because he gives individual cases, and individual cases, and I would not want Mormonism to be judged by one individual case. Individual cases are logically fallacious because they can be not representative of the sample. It's not scientific. That's why anecdotal evidence doesn't work. That's the first part of the fallacy. The second part of the fallacy, it's a fallacy of composition. The fallacy of composition is this. You say that there are properties that parts of a larger object have, and then you conclude the larger object has that property as well. Okay, well, let's think about this argument. A grain of sand is small. So that means a beach is small. Come on. It's a bad argument. The fallacy of composition is a bad argument. The fact that different religions have these problems, and then we ascribe that there have been problems with religious belief and with religious believers using their religion to justify actions, and then we conclude that this is a general thing about religion, he's committing a logical fallacy. This happens all over in the book. I almost couldn't keep from vomiting. It was so bad. And the reason is that I read the good stuff about this. Michael Martin, Atheism, A Philosophical Defense, one of the best books on philosophy of religion that I've ever read. And it is really well articulated. He deals with the best possible responses to the problem of evil, so good that even when I was at Notre Dame, I was very much a believing Mormon, and so I wanted the argument from evil to work against the Catholic God, right? And so I argued really hard with one of the guys who gives this response. And no matter what I came up with, he always had a response. And there were a bunch of other atheist students there that were with me on this, and we were all arguing against him, and he had really good responses, okay? Michael Martin deals with the arguments that Alvin Plantinga at Notre Dame deals with. It's a tough problem. The problem of evil is tough, but there are people talking about it, and it's still an open issue in academia. And those articles, those books are peer-reviewed. There are people who are experts in the field looking at them and seeing, are the arguments good here? Is this worth furthering the discussion? Here's the problem in America. The stuff that's in public discourse is not worthy of discourse. That's the problem that we have. And we've lost that public intellectualism that France once had, that England had when Bertrand Russell was the public everyone knew Bertrand Russell. There was a time in France when you could talk to a taxi driver about Derrida. We don't have that here. We have people like Ann Coulter and Christopher Hitchens and James Carville on the left. We have people like that in the public discourse. Well, no wonder we can't figure out what to do. No wonder our government is so messed up. No wonder we seem to be such a fragmented country and we can't come together in dialogue. What I would say to close is, don't read this stuff. Don't look at these books. Don't look at them for the exact same reason that you shouldn't be reading Falwell, and you shouldn't be reading Ann Coulter, you shouldn't be reading Hannity, because the arguments are just so bad. Look at the good stuff, and there's a lot of it out there. There's a lot of really good discussion of issues having to do with whether or not there's a God. And you know, there's some really good arguments that there's not. And we ought to look at those arguments instead of looking at the ones that are really poorly made. And that would help our public discourse, and I think we would do much better as a nation. It would be much easier to elect decent politicians into office if we had a decent public discourse. Thank you very much.
Okay, we've got about 22 minutes left for questions. Please come to this microphone that's in the aisle. It saves time on having to repeat the question. I'll bring the microphone to the panelists so they don't have to keep getting up. So whoever you'd like to direct the question to, I'll hand them the mic.
Jenna, I think it was just an oversight that perhaps you forgot Ayaan Hirsi Ali's book, Infidel.
No, I'm not aware of that book. You want to explain? Infidel?
Yeah, it's a... Okay. It's a book about a Somali woman.
The Canadian
she was the
woman.
ex-parliamentarian from Amsterdam.
Okay.
You may recall that Theo van Gogh, the Dutch filmmaker, was murdered in the street by an educated Islamic radical who shot him several times and put a knife in his chest with a note on it saying that Ayaan Hirsi Ali was next, which caused her to go into hiding. The book is just basically an autobiography of her leaving her traditional religion, which is Islam. She's from Somalia, and all the horrors associated with that benevolent religion. In response to Dennis, I assure you that Christopher Hitchens does know what solipsism is. I've listened to him several times. I've read his books, his articles. I will continue to do so. He's an extremely brilliant man. And I would invite people, instead of not reading, to read the books. There's a challenge, and far be it from me to have to defend these people and the personal attacks that are labeled against them. But I think in regards to your notion that it's economic depression that puts these people down, Sam Harris has a challenge for you. He compares, and incidentally, Sam Harris has no problem with religion because he says that it's the theology of the religion that is the problem. He compares Islam, for example, with its militarism, which goes back to the founding of it. It wasn't founded on benevolent missionaries going out and persuading people. It was founded on the sword. He compares that with Jainism, which was established in the 6th century by some very pacifist individuals, as the theology of Jainism is pacifist. His challenge to you is, and I heard him give this talk, he said, you find me a Buddhist monk who comes out of the prisons under the construct of the Chinese, who have brutally suppressed them in Nepal for years and killed approximately 2 million of them. Compare those people with the Palestinians who believe in a different theology and rightfully so have various grievances, yes, and there's victims all over the world. He says, you find me a Buddhist that will yell and scream blood to kill their oppressors, and he says, I will eat my book.
I have a couple things to say. That was not a book that I'm familiar with, but I did neglect to mention a couple of things that I did mean to speak about. One is Prometheus Press. Is anyone here familiar with Prometheus Press? Yeah, okay. I just wanted to call attention to that as really the premier publisher of agnostic and atheist work in this country. They've done some that is uneven and some that is excellent, but they just have launched this month an e-newsletter that's free called The Promethean. And if you go to PrometheusPress.com, you can sign up for it. They're dealing with all kinds of questions about atheism in America and non-belief around the world. The second thing that I forgot to mention is one book in particular that is very, very interesting. It's the first ever sociological study of non-believers in America. It's called Atheists, A Groundbreaking Study of America's Non-Believers. You know, you got to love it when the title actually tells you what the book is about. And in this book, the authors, who are sociologists, have surveyed atheists who are involved with atheist clubs in the United States, thinking that those would be the most involved, the most representative of atheism in America. And some of the findings are very interesting, and some of the findings are surprising. A lot of it deals with atheists' struggles to have their children educated in public schools. For whatever reason, the Christian right believes that it's very hard for Christian students to go to school. If you look at it from the atheist perspective of having children needing to sing Mary Had a Baby Boy, you get a bit of a different perspective. So I wanted to bring that up. And Dennis?
Solipsism is the view that only I exist.
I know.
But the point is that if you're religious, you think God. At least you think something else exists, God. I mean, if you're a theist, and so that's the reason I say I don't think he understands what that word means, and he shouldn't be using it in that context.
Well, why don't you characterize him properly? I mean, it'd be great if he were standing here to respond to you, but unfortunately, he's not. I'm the only person that can do that, and you're mischaracterizing him.
No, I'm not. I have gone through a lot of these arguments, and I've identified as many fallacies as I find when I read Ann Coulter or Rush Limbaugh. There was a book actually written about logical fallacies based entirely on quotes from Rush Limbaugh. I think I could do the same thing with Hitchens, with this book. There are so many logical fallacies in this book. This is so poorly written from the point of view of a philosopher of religion. Somebody who looks at these issues all the time. I teach this class every single fall with a friend of mine who differs with me. We team teach it, we argue, we get into these issues, I go back and forth, I change my mind because the arguments are persuasive enough that sometimes I go one way and sometimes I go another way, and I mean, I get really into this stuff. None of that is even addressed. There's some really interesting arguments about the design argument based on current cosmology between atheists and theists, both of whom know the physics, and they get into all of the mathematics of it. I can't even understand exactly what's going on when they're talking about this at these conferences that I go to because I don't know all the physics. But it's a live issue. They don't address that. He dismisses the design argument because Paley happened to use life as the only example of the design argument. And yeah, evolutionary theory does undermine it, and philosophers have said that. Yeah, it undermines that version of the design argument, but there's other versions of it. And there's other arguments out there. There's the argument from religious experience. And a lot of this stuff is just brushed over like it's just, oh, it's so stupid that people believe this still.
One more thing. I have to say I'm totally with Dennis here. I have also read Hitchens. I have also heard Hitchens speak. Granted, he was completely drunk at the time, as he admitted to us, and was quite proud of that fact. So maybe it's not representative of his other speeches, but somehow I think it was. I would say that if anything, we're being generous to Christopher Hitchens. I'm not a philosopher, as he has pointed out, but I am a historian. And Christopher Hitchens, in this book, makes numerous errors about history. He's a politics guy. I think he has a good understanding of politics. He has very little understanding of religion. And when I heard him speak, he made numerous errors about religion and religious history. So we need to take all of this with a grain of salt. I don't have your passion about this, but, you know, I certainly would never say, don't ever go out and read this book. It's always interesting to go out and expose yourself to other points of view and other methods of argument, even when they're bad. That's how you learn how to construct a good argument, a better argument. So, you know, by all means, read Hitchens, but please check it out of the library. Don't buy it.
I wanted to say one more thing, though, about the comment having to do with religion and violence. Actually, the example that you gave is a counterexample to the kind of argument Hitchens is trying to make. Hitchens is making the same argument that John Krakauer made in his book Under the Banner of Heaven, namely that there's an intrinsic connection between religion and violence. And Buddhism is a really good counterexample to that. I agree that religion, in some cases, is used to justify violence, and the relationship between a lot of the conflicts in the world and religion is just more complex than what he says it is. In fact, actually, I'm one of the people who's arguing, one of the people who deals with this issue in Northern Ireland. I'm one of the few who argues that religion does play a role in it. Almost everyone else that I'm arguing against says, no, it's just a socio-political fight. The IRA says, no, this has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. I mean, they were adamant. And when I suggested that the fact that they show Bobby Sands in a Christus position on one of the murals, that means that it does have something to do with religion, they were virtually, you know, they were really angry at me. When I say the IRA, I mean Sinn Féin, because I identify them. But they were really angry at me for suggesting that it might have to do with religion to some extent. But it's complex. It's not that simple. There's a lot more involved, and it's unfair to it's unfair to those conflicts. It's unfair to the issue. It's unfair to the actual academics who have done real work on it for this to be the stuff that's part of the public discourse.
I know we had another.
Thanks. I'd like to switch to a very unsophisticated question. I came here to find out whether or not God hates amputees. Do the apologists have any answer to why all the miraculous cures have never included someone who's lost an arm or a leg?
I've been a geneticist, and I would like to add genetic birth defects to that whole problem. I've seen people who have children with genetic birth defects who have gone to extreme lengths, religiously, to try to have the child healed. I've never seen it happen. So with the birth defects and with the amputees, I don't have an answer for that. But that doesn't mean that there's no God there, or there is no answer somewhere. I've heard a lot of answers. This gives you experience. This here's for a test. You agreed to this sort of thing before you came to this world. This is here to teach somebody else some you know, choice, charitable traits and so on. I find all of those quite unsatisfying. But if anybody thinks that means that science takes the day, forget it. Because we've got just as many answers that we can ask of science. We don't know scratch about origins, for instance. Even though we think we know a great deal about the origin of life on this planet, we don't. We know an incredible amount about the chemistry that had to be involved, but we don't know how to make it work. So did life start the way science usually thinks it does? That's a leap of faith, a total leap of faith. The same goes with many, many other questions. But let me maybe, from my personal experience, address one issue. Hitchens seems to say that healings will be nothing but coincidence. You just happened to get better. When I first saw the LDS movie Windows of Heaven, and how Lorenzo Snow went through all of this sort of thing to try to get rain in St. George, I was impressed. Yeah, you just wait, and you just wait, and you just wait, and sooner or later it's going to rain. Ask them down in St. George this summer. They've had precisely the same experience. I was much more impressed with Apostle John W. Taylor, who 100 years or so ago went to Cardston. They were having a drought, and he had a conference to pray for rain. And he looked out in the audience and said, "Do you really think God can make it rain?" And they said, "Yes." And he said, "No, you don't. Go home and get your umbrellas and come back, and then we'll pray for rain." And by the time the meeting was over, it was raining. Now, that's a little more interesting. But that doesn't get to the healing question. I'm very familiar with a case, for instance, where when a baby was born, that baby ripped the mother's uterus, transversely right above the cervix. It healed with a band of connective tissue that cannot stretch. That woman subsequently lost three babies that were crushed in childbirth. They were healthy right up to the time of birth. The doctor in the area, it was a rural area, apparently didn't feel that he could do a C-section. But the babies were all crushed. The doctor then was trying to go through massage, both internal, external, to try to loosen up the connective tissue of that band that prevented the cervix and the lower uterus from expanding. Not much was working. One day the woman finally went to the local LDS patriarch, and he gave her a blessing that that would be healed. She went back to the doctor the next day. She was going every day, and the band was completely gone. Her uterus was whole and complete, and she subsequently had three normal children without complications. Now, that's not coincidence. And it's not just a natural law playing itself out. We don't know of anything that really would cause connective tissue to break down and reform a functional uterus in less than 24 hours. I do know the story personally because I'm the baby that ripped my mother's uterus. And I'm speaking of my own mother. And I have two sisters and a brother that would not be here had it not been for an LDS patriarch and something that transcended anything that my biology can explain. Thank you.
Van Hale, a fairly well-known theologian who turned into an atheist but continued to do theology from an atheist point of view, called himself an atheologian. Once told this story, I have to admit that the problem of evil is probably what looms the most in my loss of faith, it's a deep problem. He said that he had lost his faith, and his nephew, evangelical Christian nephew, came to him and said, "You know, when I was in Italy evangelizing, I lost my wallet one day, and it had all our money for rent in it. And so we went home and we prayed to be able to find the wallet. And this was Rome. It was, you know, it could have been anywhere. And so they retraced as much as they could remember their path, and they found the wallet. Van Hale said to him, "If there's a God that's going to help you find your wallet in Rome, but isn't going to do anything about people starving in Africa, I don't want to have anything to do with that God." And that's where I'm at. But there are people who are theists, who do a lot of careful work on this problem, and I want to give you another book to look at. John Hick, Evil and the God of Love. And, you know, he faces that straight up. He faces that kind of problem straight up. And maybe the answer is not philosophically satisfying, but it certainly furthers the discourse a lot better than the angry, half-drunk Hitchens.
Just a quick comment that I know of one scriptural account of a healed amputee, and that is when Peter cut the ear off of the Roman soldier in the Garden of Gethsemane.
But did it really happen?
To Dennis Potter's point about having represented their sample of data points, The Economist, not exactly a fundamentalist rag, ran an issue toward the end of, you know, beginning of the 21st century, I guess. It just sort of enumerated the greatest sort of mass murder crimes of the 20th century. You know, Pol Pot, it was sort of he was a player, but not a really, really cool one like Stalin or Mao, right? But you have all these big, you know, multi-hundred thousand person murders, and very few of them were religious leaders that were hiding behind a cloak of religious power. They were hiding behind another ideology. But that's one thing I think that's missing in the books we're discussing is that, as Dennis Potter said, a more systematic view. Clearly there are issues with religion. I agree very much with Dr. Reese that the religious right deserves a huge, swift kick in the pants. What they deserve more is a lesson in critical thinking that they apply, but, you know, that's a longer discussion that would be futile. So, I think there are some issues here that a broader perspective would hopefully lead one to ask other questions. This is really the abuse of religion and not about the abuses of religion per se. They're about the abuses of ideas and power, I'd argue.
Do we have some others that came forward in the front? Were you?
Thanks to all of our panelists. I certainly have got lots of good new things to think about as a result of what each of you has had to say today. Several of you have criticized the atheist, we'll call them, the pro-atheist camp for their illogic, their fallacious reasoning, their rhetorical mistakes. I wonder what would happen if we held the standard works to those same standards. I wonder what would happen if we held the conference reports to those standards. I wonder what would happen if we played fair on both sides. Excuse me. Same story, right? And even the example that you gave, Mr. Jeffrey, and it's a touching one, I must admit. But to use that, and I think you were trying to imply there must be some divine intervention in your mother's case. That's fine, but logically, that does not suggest a God any more than when you mentioned the scientists who do their just so stories. Yours is a just so story. When you invoke that kind of logic to suggest divine intervention, you're making the mistake you criticized the other fellows for today.
I'll accept that.
And so, I
cannot repeat the experiment, and that puts it outside the realm of science.
Right, but it certainly doesn't suggest there's a God.
No, but it suggests something.
Well, but no more God than anything else. And so I was thankful for your point, Mr. Potter, that you know these folks are not playing fair with reason. We should expect more from educated scientists like Dawkins. And yet, and I think what you've called for here is we need to raise the quality of debate in public on these issues. But none of you has suggested in a fair way that religion play by those same rules, and I really think that's been missing in today's dialogue.
I would agree.
I absolutely got to respond to this. I would put this up against one of Blake Osler's book any day. Blake Osler is a careful thinker. I disagree with him on 90% of what he says, but he's really, really careful. He doesn't commit the logical fallacies that Hitchens commits, and the purpose of doing philosophy of religion, which, whether Hitchens likes it or not, he does it along the way in this book. Along the way, while he's kind of just meandering, sort of stream of consciousness attack on religion, he's doing philosophy of religion, and he's doing it really poorly. Blake does it really well. Alvin Plantinga at Notre Dame, my teacher there, does it really, really well. It was really tough for me to undermine his arguments, and I really wanted to. I actually think I finally got the argument against him, and I'm going to be sending it off to him pretty soon. But the point is that I think we can. And there's atheists out there who make really good arguments, like Michael Martin. In that book that I said that I mentioned, Atheism, a Philosophical Defense, a lot of the stuff published by Prometheus Press is really good. There's some really good, it's a really good start. It's not the best stuff. The best stuff's published by Oxford and MIT and so on. But philosophy of religion has flourished in the last 30 years for a reason, because these issues have become open again, and because we realize that reason has not settled them in the way that these guys act as if we should have been beyond this long ago. These are the most important questions in our lives, I think. They're the deepest, most important questions. And, answering these is the most important thing we can do for ourselves and for our country. Right, and so it has to be part of the public debate. Religion has to be part of it, but the quality of it has to be raised. And they're going to just give the Falwells
a better excuse to just dismiss atheism as dogmatic.
We are officially out of time, and so we should close. Unfortunately, I'm sorry about anyone who wasn't able to make their comments. And I don't know, I guess it's... Is this the last session before dinner? I guess it is. I don't want to commit the panelists to sticking around, but you might have a chance to ask them something quick, but keep in mind they want to eat too. So, but thank you so much for coming. It was a great session.